Current state on 90.5 WKAR, our first Monday of spring edition here. And we're glad you're along. Monday, March 24th, I'm Mark Bayshore. Later on this hour, Michigan State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan joins us to discuss the Education Achievement Authority and MEAP scores and the Smarter Balanced Assessment and everything else on his agenda and on the agendas of many here in Michigan with our changing education landscape. The legal status of same-sex marriage here in Michigan was taken for quite a ride over the weekend. Late Friday afternoon, Federal District Judge Bernard Friedman declared Michigan's 2004 ban on gay marriage unconstitutional. By Saturday afternoon, the clerks in four Michigan counties, Washtenaw, Muskegon, Oakland, and here in Ingham, issued hundreds of marriage licenses to same-sex couples. By Saturday afternoon, Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette's request to put the ruling on hold was granted by the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. That temporary hold lasts until Wednesday. I spoke just a few moments ago with the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta to bring us up to speed. Late Friday, U.S. District Judge Bernard Friedman issued his ruling striking down the Michigan Marriage Act as unconstitutional. Bring us up to speed here today with regard to the courts and the legal activity involved.
Well, and of course, this got a lot of attention, but we had about 300 and something couples in four counties, Oakland, Washtenaw, Ingham, and Muskegon, who were issued marriage licenses, and most of them got married that same day. Sometime toward the end of the day, in fact, while some of the couples that were waiting were still in line, the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals first set a deadline of noon tomorrow for the plaintiffs in the case, the people who are challenging the law, to file a motion on why the court should not suspend the district court judge's decision, and then a separate order that granted an emergency stay of that decision while they, you know, basically do their due deliberation on whether or not that, you know, everything should just be put on hold while the case is on appeal.
Is it known why a stay was issued? Why no stay was issued sooner?
We don't. Judges typically don't explain those decisions. That we just went through Judge Friedman's decision, and he explained that, in his opinion, based on the evidence, the scientific evidence, that there was nothing that shows that being married in a household led by a same-sex couple is harmful to children. That the state's case was weak. And that marriage is a right that people don't get to vote on the way that we did here in Michigan 10 years ago. But there was no explanation as to why he decided not to put a hold on that order, because everyone knew, including the judge, that this would certainly be appealed.
As you pointed out, hundreds of same-sex couples were issued marriage licenses Saturday in four counties, mm-hmm. including Ingham. We'll talk with Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram here in just a minute.
The very first marriage was actually in Ingham County, because Barb Byram opened an hour before everyone else.
What's the status of those marriage certificates right now?
Well, the status of those marriage certificates is they are in the possession of those couples. But beyond that, it's all in limbo. It would be very difficult to declare the marriage null and void once it's happened, but we really don't know. What we do know is that because everything's put on hold, that anything that those couples might have done today with their new rights, such as, you know, start adoption proceedings on children that they're raising together, that cannot happen yet.
Is there a precedent we can look at, though? Because Michigan's not the first state to go through this. Utah, others.
Utah is the case that everyone's looking at right now, and one of the reasons why everyone sort of felt that eventually the court would grant a stay is because that's what happened in the Utah case, that a couple of weeks went by and, you know, the people were getting married before the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and said, you know, just cut it out while everything gets sorted through.
So we'll have more legal machinations tomorrow and then again on Wednesday. How long might this process take?
Well, you know, there are no hard and fast deadlines. What we know right now is that the Sixth Circuit said that everything is on hold until Wednesday. And there's even a little bit of disagreement as to whether that means it's on hold through the balance of Tuesday and is lifted on Wednesday, or if it lasts all the way through Wednesday, although experience would suggest that the Court of Appeals is not going to allow the stay to be lifted without some decision on whether or not the court will enjoin the decision.
And how likely is it, Rick, that this case makes it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, it's really hard to say, Mark. On the one hand, unlike last summer when and in the fall when we were expecting maybe something would happen quickly, we're no longer first in line. There are quite a few cases, quite a few states where this is already being litigated. But there is one unique thing about the Michigan case, which is Judge Friedman made this a trial about the scientific studies, the evidence on the effects of children and families when it comes to being raised in same-sex households. And no other case really has that record. And so that would certainly suggest that, Michigan would be a ripe case to be probably part of a combined set of states that go before the United States Supreme Court.
Rick Pluta covers the Capitol for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, thanks for your help this morning, and thanks for all your hard work over the weekend.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark.
And with us now in Studio S here at Current State, Emily Devendorf, the Managing Director for Equality Michigan, a statewide LGBT advocacy group. Welcome back, Emily.
Thank you.
And also with us, Ingham County Clerk Barb Byram, who issued the state's first marriage license to a same-sex couple in Michigan here on Saturday morning. Welcome back, Barb.
Thank you.
Current State did reach out to Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette to join us today. We did not hear back from the AG's office soon enough for this segment. Emily, what was your reaction to Judge Friedman's ruling on Friday?
On Friday, of course, we were overjoyed. We have had quite the weekend of ups and downs, but on Friday we were thrilled to have a decision and to be able to look forward to a weekend of action and of our dignity and our humanity being validated.
What have you been hearing from your supporters? What kinds of things?
Our supporters are ready to move forward and ready to move their families into greater stability. We've been denied access to resources, access to basic rights, and we have families, we have partners, so we want to be able to provide for them in the way that every Michigander should be able to provide for their partners and families.
Barb Byram, you issued the state's first marriage license to a same-sex couple. What compelled you to open for business on Saturday morning?
Well, Friday night we got word that the ban was ruled unconstitutional. And by then, my vault was locked. Most of my staff was gone. And I said, well, we'll take applicants Monday morning. But I couldn't sleep with myself. I just couldn't sleep Friday night. And then I decided that if it was feasible, then perhaps I could open on Saturday. So I sent a text message to my staff in an hour I'd prefer not to admit to. And they didn't respond, which most people shouldn't have responded to that text message. A few hours later, I sent them another text message. And a couple hours after that, I got the first response from my first staff member. It was about 6:15 in the morning. And she said, I'll be there. I'm ready to go. And that's when I realized it would be feasible to open up the office. So that's when I started letting people know that the Ingham County Clerk's Office would be open for business at 8 a.m. Saturday morning. After that, more and more staff members said that they would be there. So we are operating at full strength Saturday morning. My staff is absolutely amazing. They came to work on a Saturday morning to serve the public, and I so appreciate that. I had volunteers show up. I had five officiants show up just to help officiate ceremonies. My mom showed up. My husband showed up. My kids think they helped. But, you know, it was
amazing. They think they helped.
They think they helped. They're 4 and 6, so help is a relative term. It was absolutely amazing. We issued, by the time the day was over, 57 marriage licenses. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing.
There are some people suggesting that you and other county clerks were complicit in this legal confusion by opening your doors on Saturday morning. Any response to that?
You know, I was compelled to open the office. These couples that showed up at my courthouse Saturday morning have been together for decades. And to make them wait 2 more days to get married was unconscionable.
There's no question of your legal authority to open the office on a day that you're not formally scheduled to conduct business?
I have absolutely no question that I had the authority to open the office Saturday morning.
Okay. Emily, what's wrong with the state's argument here? Let's revisit one of the basics here. I mean, the Michigan Marriage Act was approved by voters 10 years ago. Why shouldn't it stand?
Well, as the judge found in his decision, it does violate the Equal Protection Clause. LGBT people are treated unequal under the law by having this ban in our state constitution. It creates disparities between families, between same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples in Michigan when we place a ban on marriage equality for same-sex couples, and we have marriage for opposite-sex couples. The judge found that there was no rational basis for keeping the ban on same-sex marriage. The state doesn't benefit from the ban. And the state was trying to make the argument that the state somehow benefited from having a ban on same-sex marriage, and it just simply does not. It does not add to the stability of Michigan families to have the ban in place. In fact, the judge found, and all of the experts that offered testimony in the case found, that it actually adds to instability for Michigan families. It creates stability in the home because it creates discrimination against LGBT families, and it creates discrimination. It creates instability that otherwise would not exist. And again, disparity between families in Michigan that would not exist.
This is an issue that has become a social and an economic issue in many respects, but marriage has its roots in religion. It is one of 7 sacraments. Does it concern you that over time, folks who adhere to particular religious beliefs might never come around and get on board with same-sex marriage?
It does not concern me. We all have the right to our own religious beliefs, and that is one of the wonderful things about our country. And we should be able to continue to have our own individual religious beliefs. And that is another constitutional right. So we can continue to have beliefs against or for same-sex relationships, and our churches can continue to decide whether they want to perform ceremonies for same-sex couples. That will continue to be a right that each church has. But we cannot discriminate in our laws, in our Constitution, against certain groups of people. Religion cannot mix with law to discriminate against certain groups of people. We can have religious freedoms and we can have civil rights, and we should not be mixing the two to discriminate and to harm people.
Were you at the courthouse on Saturday morning?
Yes, I was. Okay. I live in Ingham County, so I wanted to see my friends get married, and it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. And as Barb said, one of the things that I noticed that was especially poignant was that the majority of the couples that got married that day had been together for decades, and there were a great number of couples, and they were couples that you don't normally see out in the movement holding a sign They are couples who have been active in their community, working daily jobs that we all do, living and building quiet lives and supporting each other, and living and doing the same things that we all do. These are people that you know and love, and they've been loving and supporting each other for decades, and it goes against the assumptions that a lot of people have, and I wish everybody was there to see that.
Michigan same-sex marriage opponent Gary Glenn, who you have appeared, Emily, on this program with, made a disparaging remark over the weekend over decisions being made by, quote, lawyers in black robes, or a lawyer in a black robe. Barb, any particular response to that?
That just shows the level of disrespect he has for the federal judge and for people that don't see his views of things. I think it's imperative that Michigan finally becomes an equality state where all people are treated equal in our state.
Are you confident about what will happen Tuesday and Wednesday, Barb? Are you confident? Are you anxious? What?
You know, I am still getting over the weekend and how much love and support there was over the weekend. We will be sending a letter to the U.S. Attorney General, encouraging him to recognize and have these marriage ceremonies recognized as legal marriages, because they most certainly are. And I look forward to continuing the fight for equality in our state.
Emily, what about you? Are you more anxious or more confident?
We are more driven.
That wasn't an option.
Yeah, yes. Once the temporary stay was put into place, we immediately started a petition to ask the Attorney General to drop the appeal. And within 24 hours, in less than 24 hours, about 8,000 Michigan citizens signed the petition, and the petition continues to grow. So by the middle of Tuesday, we'll be presenting the petition to the Attorney General and the governor's office, asking them to drop the appeal. We don't expect that they'll do that, but Michigan citizens are quickly and loudly vocalizing that they are not on the Attorney General's side with this, that they were happy to see Michigan citizens being able to embrace their civil rights, their basic humanity, and that they are embarrassed by the Attorney General continuing to defend discrimination in Michigan and would like this to stop. So we are just continuing to move forward, and we will do whatever we can to support the legal team and to support the Deborah Rouse family and to come at this from every direction. We're still educating the whole state on why marriage equality matters and laying the foundation for a ballot measure if we have to go that route, and making sure that the family and the legal team has every resource they need to win along the way.
Emily Diefendorf is the Managing Director for Equality Michigan. Barb Byram is the Ingham County Clerk. Thanks to both of you. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last week, after months of debate, the Michigan House voted narrowly to expand the state's Education Achievement Authority. That's the district charged with turning around the state's 15 lowest performing schools. The highly debated measure, which is now before the state Senate, is one of many on Michigan's continually evolving education landscape. Others include new testing for student growth and evaluating teacher effectiveness and the Common Core curriculum, and several others. To discuss these, we welcome Michigan School Superintendent Mike Flanagan. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mark. And by the way, I'm happy to be an Evergreen member when I leave here, if it turns out that my wife hasn't done that, and I don't think we did it yet. So let me do that before I leave.
How convenient.
Yeah.
I'd like to spend some time talking about the EAA here. Do you expect the Senate will approve this revised EAA expansion measure?
You know, I just don't know anymore. One reason that I actually canceled the contract with the EAA, which gave them a year notice, was because I wasn't sure what the legislature was going to do, and I need some options about a year from now for where those schools should go. By the way, that doesn't mean some wouldn't go to the EAA. But this is a bit of a misnomer. It's not an EAA bill. It's a bill that kind of codifies, at least in the House version last week, codifies some options for me. So I'm happy with that. because there's some schools that will be taken over, 10 or so perhaps, that would be better served by another school district. And there's probably some that would be served well by the EAA also.
This would expand the district. It would include ISDs, intermediate school districts, as potential collaborators with these troubled schools.
Right, but they're only expanded if I, as state superintendent, decide that schools go into that district. I mean, a lot of people have forgotten that this law actually became law under Governor Granholm.
True. Yeah.
And this was created a statewide school district. And when Governor Snyder came on board, I don't report to the governor, but I work well with both of them, with Governor Granholm and Governor Snyder, and said, we really need a way to operationalize this. And that's when they started to think about something called the EAA. Didn't know what it would be called at the time. So, you know, this has been a kind of a history of trying to figure a way out of 4,000 schools, by the way. The overwhelming number are doing a great job. These teachers work very hard. They're doing a great job in this state. There's a handful of them that, you know, you and I wouldn't have our kids or grandkids go to, so I'm prepared a year from now to make that change.
Well, if this measure were to make it all the way through and the district were to be expanded and altered in roughly this way, how would you expect it to perform?
Well, one of the things that I try not to jump on, even traditional districts, so I'm certainly not going to do it with the EAA, is it takes time. These are schools. Talk about the 15 that are in the EAA now. These are schools that have failed their kids for decades. So it's basically 1 year's data, and there's an argument, you know, that I'm not going to get in the middle of right now because I haven't examined the data, but it's 1 year's data. And whether they're improving or not, this takes 3, 4, 5 years. So next year, if we have some ISDs and local districts that are willing to take these schools, I can't possibly hold them accountable 1 year later for have you finally turned them around.
Are you confident that a measure like the one before the legislature would address concerns that people have, like transparency, like questionable progress, declining enrollment?
Yes. I mean, as I understand the bill, I think it would do that. One way or the other, we're going to be transparent about it. Any of the schools that we put in, and they'll only go in, whether they have a cap or no cap or anything, it still comes down to whether or not the department is going to take any schools and put them into this state reform district. And then from the state reform district, they can go to a number of places under this law. You know, even without the law, that's one reason I needed to cancel a contract. And it got really perceived to be totally anti-EAA. I was just saying I have to have other options. There are some schools that are going to be better served by other institutions, including ISDs and local districts.
How do you feel? I mean, you do have 1 year's worth of data. How do you feel about that data?
Well, I think it's a student-centered type system that they're using that seems to have merit even in traditional districts. So this is why it's situational. Some kids will learn very well in kind of a computer-based student-centered format, and others won't. So as we examine these schools for possible takeover a year from now or so, we're going to try to match them up with where we think they're going to have the best chance of turnaround.
A lot of Republicans, including the governor, I believe, frequently suggest that it's much more important to do something, even if it's imperfect, than do nothing. What do you make of that assertion?
Yeah, it's now that you've said it that way, I'm afraid to answer. But I get the spirit behind that. The spirit is that these kids in some of these same schools for 30, 40, 50 years have not been served. So something has to happen. Now, if it turns out, let's say the EAA or any other entity that starts working with these schools down the road, if they're not making progress in 3 and 4 years, we need to change that. We need to change that and improve it. But right now, I think what I'll call the Granholm Law with kind of the Snyder operational plan is a way to try to move forward with the schools that have failed our kids. I also want to say every time I say schools failed, I feel responsible as state superintendent to say the overwhelming number are doing a great job with our children.
The three most common views toward the EAA seem to be, one, it's off to a good enough start to warrant expansion. Two, it's too early to say what effect it's having, but it's still too soon to expand. And three, unmitigated fail. Which of those do you fall into?
Well, I don't have to pick one because I'll have another year's data by the time we do this. So it'll be clearer to me a year from now with 2 years of data on the EAA whether they seem to be headed in the right direction. If they're not, I probably won't put any schools in that EAA. But if they are, and I have hope that they will be, that they'll be on track. But if they're not, you know, that's why I need other options. You know, it's not like it's going to be an easy lift. Let's say there's a school that's in a district that's not doing well right now. The school isn't. But right next door, there's a district where a very similar school with the same kind of demographics, high poverty, high free lunch, is doing well. I'm going to really push that next door district to take this school for 5 years or so. I'm going to say, you've already proven you can do this. So would you please help us out with the kids that are 1 mile away from you, just over kind of an artificial border that we call a school district that got set up, who knows, 100 years ago.
Do you see that particular course of action taking place?
I do. That's what my hope is. That's why, in a way, I'm glad this is going to play itself out for another year or so, because my job's going to be, because I don't think the law mandates that they have to take them, nor should they. But I'm going to really work to try to see if districts nearby who've had success will consider working with those schools for 5 years or so. ISDs are another possible vehicle under this. I know they've said they want right of first refusal on it, and I'm going to give them the chance.
One more question on the EAA, and we will move on, I assure you. But some of the most emotional opponents of the EAA are upset over the involvement of the Broad Foundation in this, and they claim that the foundation's mission is to upend traditional public education with things like the Broad Superintendent's Academy, to weaken teacher unions. Can you shed any light on Mr. Broad's and his foundation's involvement in Detroit and the EAA?
Well, overall, I mean, here I am right around the corner from the Broad Museum that he donated to Michigan State, so I'm going to be careful. But I really don't have any inside information about the financing of the EAA. I mean, I'm just, any more than I would what foundations are helping out Pontiac or Farmington or, you know, Kentwood. It's just not in our wheelhouse, so I don't have, but I have no reason to believe there's a problem. I mean, I think if there's major benefactors that are willing to help out education institutions, whether it's Bill Gates or Broad, I'm for it.
Their suspicions are generally unfounded, in your opinion?
I just wouldn't have any way to know one way or the other. I would suspect they're unfounded, but I sure as heck wouldn't want to say that and find out that there's something down the road. I can't imagine that. I mean, I don't even think Michigan State would be involved with Broad alum, whether he's an alum or not, if you know, he wasn't an honorable person.
We're talking with State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan. The latest MEEP scores were released about 3 weeks ago. There were a number of areas where encouraging longer-term trends continue, reading and math in particular. On a more discouraging note, social studies and science scores were down. How do you interpret those?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly more work to do on social studies and science. Part of that is we haven't had accountability measures around those. So now that that's happening, you're going to see more of a focus. But to me, the main one is reading. If you can get kids reading by grade level in third grade, and then they read to learn after that, they learn to read by third grade, they read to learn after that. So many of the other problems that are so-called educational problems take care of themselves. And we've gone, once I redid the cut scores, the State Board of Education and I redid the cut scores in this state 3 or 4 years ago, and everyone, you know, went bananas for a while, that really not 90% of our kids were reading at grade level in third grade, but it was 59%. Okay, that was a wake-up call. Having said that, we've gone from 59% to 70% of the kids reading at grade level in third grade now. So that's a big victory. That tells you that our schools and our teachers, when they have a goal to reach and there's clarity about that, they're going to meet that goal.
The State House continues work on a pair of bills, tie-barred bills, as they say, involving third-grade reading proficiency. One of those bills would hold back a third grader not proficient in reading. The other would implement interventions between kindergarten and third grade to minimize the number of kids forced to repeat. How confident are you that those interventions in, it's 5144, House Bill 5144, how confident are you that those interventions in that measure are enough to keep the number of repeating students acceptably low?
I'm in favor of the intervention bill. I'm opposed to the one for the automatic retention. I do think the—
And why?
Well, I think that's up to the local district, the parents, and the teacher for each individual child. You know, my dad, who was a very successful guy, he got GI Bill guy, went to school at night, eventually became assistant treasurer in New Jersey. I didn't know till he was dying, literally the last couple of days, when he almost said to us, he was almost in tears saying he wanted to get it off his chest, and we're all waiting with bated breath what this was, that he was left back in elementary school. This had been, you know, this had been a burden forever. There's a lot of kids that are wrecked by that. So there's other, you know, the more we can get to not being as concerned about grades, but by mastery, that's the model that I think our whole system has to work towards. So it's not like, you know, most kids are not at fourth grade level in every area, but we call them fourth graders. So the more we can shift to where you're really mastering subjects, that's where we want to go. But in the meantime, we're still kind of stuck in this traditional grade level structure. You need to really be sure, and I trust the parent, the local district, and the local teacher to make that decision rather than just unilaterally have a legislative mandate that they have to be retained for a year.
Let's clarify, though. Is your department not endorsing the this measure because of the mandatory retention, or are you actively opposing it?
No,
is there a difference there between not endorsing and opposing?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure whether there is an act. I mean, I'm speaking for myself as state superintendent. I'm a constitutional officer, just like the attorney general. And I'm saying that I don't think that's the right direction, is to go with automatic retention. But I think we're going to, whatever goes into law, we're going to enact. You know, that's a different ballgame. So, I mean, we've enacted and taken care of things because the law requires that I'm not always in agreement with, but that's the nature of our work. But in this case, I think it's important for me in my role as state superintendent to say why I think the interventions is a better way to go, and then let those decisions on whether or not there's retention, which should be very few, is made by the local district with, you know, basically the parents and the teacher.
You've reviewed your last MEEP scores, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Yes, I mean, the MEEP's over. It's 40-year run. You know, it's funny.
It goes back that far, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's time to go. I mean, and if we hadn't had, with 30 other states, the $300 million that Race to the Top provided in order to design what it's called a Smarter Balance series of tests, we wouldn't have been able to do it. We'd still probably be stuck with MEEP. But the intent now is that we won't test next fall, as we've done forever. We're going to move to the spring. So there's more time for kids to learn. And, you know, the problem with the fall testing has been kids come back, you know, they've lost some learning over the summer, and then we immediately test them. So we're going to move it to the spring. And that spring will be Smarter Balance tests, and we hope that the legislature, of course, supports that and appropriates money for that. It's a much more nuanced test. It's going to help, you know, for instance, the legislature, with the best of intentions, and I would support the idea that you need to evaluate teachers, and part of it needs to be on student growth. But there's no way to measure student growth in a fair way if we don't have the Smarter Balance tests a year from this spring. So that's our goal. That's why we keep testifying, and I hope, you know, the wise decision will be made to appropriate money for the Smarter Balance tests. If not, we don't have any tests next year. If we don't have any tests next year, we lose our waiver with the federal government. We put at jeopardy the $1.5 billion that we get from title money. So, I mean, frankly, this is a no-brainer to me. I'm not even clear on why we're debating this. And, you know, there's another thing. I met with counselors last week, and this was their formal association. They didn't realize we're still going to have the ACT college entrance exam.
I know there was some confusion about that.
Oh, my gosh. This is
so
still...
the ACT is not going away.
No. And the ACT is the core of that at the high school level. It's just that we have other tests required from grades 3 through 11, and those are going to be the Smarter Balance tests and then some wraparounds in the high school. But the ACT, just as an aside, we're going out for bid again this next December. DTMB, the Management and Budget, decides these bids. But if ACT has products from 3 to 11, which they didn't have last time and didn't bid, and this time they bid in December and win it for the next go-around, that would be great. But at this point in time, what we have with the bids that went out a few years ago is Smarter Balance, and then the ACT college entrance exam as the core of that. So that's something our kids are still going to have, free college entrance exams through the ACT, and we're proud of that.
Can you explain how often kids will be tested at the Smarter Balanced?
Well, it's approximately the same. I mean, the windows, we just met Friday trying to reduce the windows enough so that it's not spread out throughout a whole year with different grades. But there's a point where our biggest challenge on all of this testing, by the way, is going to be about 70% of our schools are ready for online testing. And the handful that aren't, by the way, that's one reason we have to have a larger window of time so that they can use the limited technology they have a number of times, you know, in other words, to get our kids tested and not all on one day. The only thing that's required on one day is ACT. That's under their rules, and that's a paper and pencil test anyway. So we're at a point where we have paper and pencil backup for all the rest. I think the plan, which we've had in place, State Board and the department and I have had in place for 3 years, is move from finally be done with the MEEP, move from next fall to the following spring, and go to Smarter Balance, wrapping around the ACT college entrance exam.
Can you talk a little bit more about how the Smarter Balanced will tell you more about a teacher's performance in the classroom?
Well, there's a number of growth measures in there. You just don't get that from MEEP tests. And, you know, I guess for your audience and even for me, I mean, I'm not a psychometrician. We have psychometricians on staff, a couple of them PhDs here from state. We're at a point where, think about it, every day almost, I update my apps on my iPhone. There's always some that are updated, yeah. Bug fixes, a few improvements. It's been 40 years. So the Smarter Balance literally has nuanced ways to have fair growth measured for teachers. Now, think about it. That's very different for a third grade teacher that's measured on growth for all the subjects that she or he is, you know, responsible for versus, let's say, a calculus teacher. So that's why this was a very expensive project, and thank goodness there was Race to the Top money. You're developing banks of tests that are for this full array of teachers. We have 105,000 teachers in this state. Some are elementary. Some are content-type folks at the high school level. You know, that would be either math or science or, you know, language.
But are you taking student scores and inferring the teacher's performance in this role because the student scores are being better measured?
Well, the law calls for up to 50% of a teacher's evaluation being based on student scores and growth. So that's what we'll do. But that's why I'm saying you accumulate this. So my daughter's a public school teacher. She's got about 160 kids a day. So it's not any one child, but it's kind of this aggregate. That's why it's a very sophisticated testing system. This aggregate can show by the end of the year that she's actually taken 160, and not every one of them, but in general has moved the ball.
Okay.
An easier example would be, let's say a third grade teacher, back to the reading thing. Let's say a bunch of her class isn't reading at grade level. We're not expecting that person has to show about a year's growth for the time they have the children. So the tests are nuanced enough so someone who's only reading at grade level of first grade level but gets to second grade, the teacher should be rewarded for that, even though it's a third grade teacher. On the other hand, a third grade teacher might have some child. I mean, I saw Barb Byram earlier, and she said her child's already reading in kindergarten, which is marvelous. So if that same teacher has someone who's reading at fourth grade level, they still should be able to get growth there and demonstrate that. And you know what? Sitting here in the university, we can then take all this data and track it back to where teachers were prepared. Think about that. So finally, what you understand, not as a punishment, but you could see Michigan State, the dean here. I'm going to speak Thursday to students here at Michigan State, the teacher ed program, and you could have those realizing, gosh, our teachers that are prepared in physics, for the sake of discussion, aren't doing as well as we would like because they can see that once they go out into the field, they're not getting student growth.
The week before last, we dived into proposed changes to state rules regarding special education. Proponents say the changes bring state standards into line with federal standards. Opponents claim it'll be catastrophic for special needs students. Do you have a particular perspective on this discussion?
Well, you know, I heard that show, by the way. I was driving home and I heard, and these are heartfelt concerns. I mean, if you're a special needs parent, you want to make sure that somehow this isn't going to affect your child. So I do get that. It's not even at my desk yet. And that's why we had public comment. And so if I see this when it gets to my desk with a preponderance of public comment that's against a given rule, I'm not going to move that rule any further. Period.
We've been looking forward to your visit for a long time. We really appreciate your coming in. Our state school superintendent, Mike Flanagan, many thanks.
Pleasure, Mark. Thanks.